This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Adams is one of the best-known composers in contemporary opera. Peter Sellers is one of the best-known directors. My guest, Sanford Sylvan, doesn't have the same name recognition they do, but he's one of the acclaimed singers who's brought their work to life. Sylvan was Zhou Enlai in John Adams' Nixon in China, which was directed by Peter Sellers, and Sylvan performed in Sellers' televised productions of Figaro and Così fan tutte. Sylvan is singing the title role in a new Adams-Sellers collaboration called The Death of Klinghoffer. This opera about terrorists and hostages will have its American premiere at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in September. Sylvan also has a new record. It's his first solo record, and it's called Beloved That Pilgrimage. But first I want to play an earlier recording. John Adams wrote a setting of a Walt Whitman poem for Sylvan. That poem, The Wound Dresser, was based on Whitman's experiences as a nurse in the Civil War. This is The Wound Dresser.
Bearing the bandages, water and sponge, straight and swift to my wounded I go. They lie on the ground after the battle brought me.
Sanford Sylvan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, I read in an interview with you that you've said when you think of this song, you think of friends who have died of AIDS. What are some of the different settings that you've performed the song in?
Well, we've done it in concert halls kind of all across the country, huge barns and then smaller places. And I think what I was talking about in that article specifically was being in San Francisco singing, that we had finished a tour, a very long tour at the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and one of the last performances was in San Francisco. And, you know, I don't often think about specific settings of where I am. I find that limits me, you know, when I'm performing. So I just go out and perform in as absolute a nature as I can find within myself. But it really struck me that afternoon when I walked out on stage in San Francisco that here I was going to sing words to a community who really knew what I was singing about. Because, you know, in a sense, San Francisco and the gay community and AIDS is where it all began, in a sense. And so it just felt very, that identification, that complete, you know, it's like until you sing German Lieder to a German audience, it's very hard to understand that kind of two-way electricity. We're used to that with pop music, you know, we listen to Frank Sinatra and we get it, and there's a two-way street back and forth, And this, somehow the language and the evocation of all that was going on seemed absolutely as immediate as anything I've ever experienced.
I'm wondering if you've been asked to sing at any funerals.
There's a church that I'm associated with in Boston called Emmanuel Church, and they were one of the first churches to deal with people who had died of AIDS, and at a time when certain churches were not accepting people who had died of AIDS. And so I offered myself as part of my own work to sing, and I sang at some funerals. And it was, that often they would ask me to sing specific things, and sometimes it was very, very difficult. I had to sing Somewhere at someone's funeral, and you know.
The Bernstein Sondheim?
The Bernstein Sondheim, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which, in a way, is for a lot of gay people very much a personal anthem.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I'm interested in what it's like to sing at a funeral, because it's not a concert. It's not about performing. It's kind of about registering emotion in a kind of different way, certainly in a different context than at a concert. So what do you feel is different about what's expected of you and what's appropriate from you?
Well, the two times that I've chosen or asked to sing at funerals, it was done for me in a sense of what I could offer. I really remove my own. It's not a grieving process for me. It can't be part of that, because then I could never be able to sing. So I usually do it as an offering, both once for a wonderful director, Tim Mayer, I asked and was happy to sing at his funeral, and my cousin who died in 103, Pan Am 103, and it just seemed appropriate. It was the appropriate response at that moment for me, for my family, and then I take the grieving process within myself on another occasion.
So it's possible to move other people without kind of giving in too much to that emotion yourself.
Right, just focusing. I mean, it's like singing, actually, it's like singing at a wedding in the same, I don't sing at weddings except for people who I dearly love. And when you do that, you know, you can't start kind of letting the emotion of the occasion get to you. But that we come in contact with that all the time, you know, occasions, times when we're performing. I was thinking the other day that the first time I sang the Britain War Requiem, which is one of the great pieces of all time, I really had to say to myself as I was walking on stage, you know, just focus and don't listen to the rest of the piece, because if I did, I would never be able to get through it. Because, you know, in oratorio, you sit there the whole time. You don't go off stage anywhere. And so you just focus and work with what, you know, with what you need to say.
Yeah. I want to show a different side of your singing. And this is an aria that you sing in The Death of Klinghoffer, which you're about to perform
right.
in the States. And this is an opera by John Adams,
mm-hmm.
who you've worked with before.
Right.
And it's based on the death of Leon Klinghoffer, who was one of the hostages on the Achille Lauro in 1985,
right.
and he was thrown overboard by Palestinian terrorists.
Right, shot and then thrown overboard.
Right.
Right.
You know, a lot of people, when they hear Leon Klinghoffer made into an opera, think, how do you make a subject like that into an opera? Was that ever an obstacle for you, you know, in thinking about playing the role of Klinghoffer?
Well, frankly, we thought that Richard Nixon was even a stranger idea for an opera.
Right. This is Nixon in China. You're
Nixon in China. So we've kind of gotten over that aspect of, you know, the contemporary issues and whether they seem strange or not.
I want to play an excerpt of one mm-hmm. of your arias in which you're expressing your rage
right.
at the terrorists.
Right.
Can you talk with me a little bit about singing this and about what you're conveying?
Sure. You know, John, like any great composer, writes music that says more than one thing at a time. And I guess I've always felt that this piece is as much anything as is about his impotence. He cannot jump out of the chair, as it were, and save anybody. He cannot be a hero.
The wheelchair, because he's...
The wheelchair,
right.
He was
right. in a wheelchair.
He was in a wheelchair. He cannot, for instance, at that moment, physically save or protect his wife. And that is the stuff that I've always used to fuel myself in that aria. You know, impotence, anger, rage, outrage. You know, all the things that any of us would feel were we stuck... that way, I guess, as it were. You know, I've never been, thank God, taken a hostage. I don't know what that feels like. And I think that we're learning slowly from the hostages that are being released that it's a very multifaceted experience. I thought it was incredible. I was reading the other day about how they were teaching each other, you know, their subjects or what their life was about, and I thought that was extraordinary. So for this moment, I think it's very much an incredible mixture of anger, impotence, physical challenge, as it were.
Well, let me play some of this aria
sure.
from The Death of Klinghoffer, performed right. by my guest Sanford Sylvan.
Mr. Powell, who shot that little girl at the airport in Rome? You would have done the same. There's much anger in you. And I know how children in the promised land learn to sleep on the ground because of your shoving. Old men at the wedding wall get a knife in the back. You laugh, you pour gasoline over women passengers on the bus to Tel Aviv and burn. Give a shit, excuse me, about your grandfather's hut, his sheep and his goat, and the land he wore out. You don't give a shit, you just want to see people die.
I think it must be really good for a singer like you to be able to perform like elegiac songs and to perform really angry music
right.
like this.
Right. It's fun. I think we first discovered, Peter had a phrase for it. He like, he loves my latent street thug, as he calls it. And in this production of Così fan tutte that we did years ago and then has become now well-known through the TV and video version, it was a very interesting thing for me to explore the side of myself that has that much rage and anger within myself, and then to dare myself to not have an audience like me, which is a very big issue, and was a wonderful, wonderful therapy for me to get out on stage in Cozy and really challenge the audience to just want to, you know, want me to leave the stage, you know. And we filled Cozy with all these incredible moments of mean-spirited kind of just obnoxious behavior. And it was a real challenge for me, but I ended up loving it. I think it really liberated me as a performer, you know, so I didn't have to worry about people loving me all the time, which is a dangerous thing for any of us to get involved with.
Why was it so hard? Is it because you're not that used to acting and you're normally performing in a recital context?
No, because recital is as dramatic. It's just that, you know, I think most performers, you know, face this issue of, you know, being true to the work. And if I am thus true to the work, you know, what happens, what will people think of me, you know, separating oneself from the work? And that's a continual process that we all go through. But there were many moments in this production where we actually took it further. For instance, there's a very beautiful trio in the first act of Cozy, which is beautiful. And in our production, it was one of the few moments of actual kind of tenderness and quietness. And literally, the second it was done, there was huge crash of plates, and I'm screaming at the audience, and I could feel people absolutely just rear back and kind of think, I wish you wouldn't do that, you know. And that's a big thing for a performer. We all have to face those issues of wanting people to like us.
Sanford Sylvan is my guest. He has a new album called Beloved That Pilgrimage. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Baritone Sanford Sylvan is my guest. I think most of the operas that you've performed in have been operas by John Adams or directed by Peter Sellars. They've been unconventional operas, either contemporary mm-hmm. operas or contemporary right. updatings of,
right.
Of classic operas.
Right.
Why have you avoided more traditional opera?
It's a long... It could be a long answer. I don't know. It's a question whether I've avoided. It's a question of not seeing what I thought opera was about being done around me, and so not finding situations that I could put myself into where I thought that the issues of opera were being addressed. And when I finally saw Peter's work and was asked to be involved, I knew that this is what I had waited for all those years. I knew that we were going to address the issues the way I, you know, think, the issues that I think are important in being addressed, that were addressed by the composer and the librettist. And so it's kind of like that opportunity presented itself finally. It's harder for me to say what I didn't find in these other representations than to say what I did find in what we do.
Which is?
Treating every character as a full and rich human being, never, ever judging our characters from the outside or the inside. In our productions, there are no stock figures. We never make fun of people, per se. We make fun of ourselves. But the characters are as full and rich as you or I would like to be treated, you know, as human beings. I think that's the most important and most basic tenet of Peter's work.
How did you discover classical singing? I mean, that might sound like a dumb question, but
not at all.
Of people just grow up with pop and rock and roll.
No, I sang in a chorus always when I was a kid. It's a wonderful story. Lincoln Center Library opened up in 1966, I think. And I was 12, and I thought I was interested in plays, so I went up there because someone said, oh, they probably have a lot of plays there because it's about performing arts. And they had a little film right in the front, a little slideshow about ballet and music and opera and this and that. And I had never seen an opera because in those days there was no opera on TV or anything like that. And I was amazed. And it was 2 minutes of Aida, of Leontine Price singing the triumphal scene from Aida. And I was just kind of blown away, basically. And I stood and watched the same film for about 7 viewings, which took about 2 hours. And then I went upstairs and searched around and asked the person next to me what that was. And he said, it's an opera. It's called Aida. And I went and got the record on my library card, and that was it. really.
Did your parents play any music like that in the house?
No, not at all. We had a piano, so we grew up taking piano lessons, and there was no classical music per se. I don't know why I was drawn to it. When I was a kid, I'd kind of spin the dial, and if there was some opera playing, I might lean in, but it wasn't a part of our household. My parents listened to, you know, Friend in Teicher, of course, and, you know, and Broadway musicals, but beyond that. And I actually didn't listen to very much music before I found myself interested in classical music. I only listened to pop and rock as an adult and became very much, very, very much influenced by certain rocks, you know, pop and rock artists.
Oh, let me stop you there, because I'm interested in hearing you say that. Sure. You know, opera is a form that precedes pop and rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
People started singing that way long before Elvis Presley or Frank Sinatra. But
right.
You're singing it after Presley and Sinatra, and after
right.
Everybody who's come after Presley and Sinatra. So
right.
Do you think that that's changed your approach to singing? And I'm asking that because, you know, pop singers have brought a colloquialism into
right.
singing that didn't exist before, and of course microphones help them do that.
Right. I don't think so, frankly. The influence that the popular and rock artists brought to me were later, it was kind of later in my mid-20s when I think I had a general idea of what I wanted to do with my singing, and it just was much more, I became, for instance, very much influenced by Bruce Springsteen. But that was as an artist and as a performer, less about vocal technique than just what that man did as a performer and as a musician and as a composer.
How are you interested, influenced by Springsteen as a performer? I doubt you run across the stage with your guitar.
Well, it's more just kind of artistic truth, and that I think he speaks from the deepest possible place when he sings and when he performs. It's every time as if, you know, he could die after that. There's a connection, you know. I used to think, I'll never forget, I saw John Vickers sing a Tristan once, and I thought, it's like he could die from how far he's taking this within himself. And I feel that often when I've seen Springsteen perform. I feel just unbelievably moved by the commitment and the totality of his approach. I also happen to think he sings very beautifully, and everyone, you know, kind of just can't believe it, but I do. I think he sings beautifully. I think he uses his voice just beautifully, even when it's tired, even when he's been shouting a lot. As a singer, you know, the colors are endless. He makes endless choices of how to use words and line and emotion. Absolute emotion.
No, I agree with you. Do you ever feel like you know, you're saying that, you know, a singer who gets so deep into himself, he could like die from going that deep.
Uh huh.
Do you ever feel like you're doing that yourself? And can you tell when you are? And does that coincide with when the people you're singing to feel that you've done your best?
Sometimes not. You would be amazed. Sometimes you feel like you've just given everything, and someone will come backstage and say, "Are you okay?" And you want to punch them.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a real thin line for us. We have to walk a line of a certain kind of technical proficiency, because it is on that line that we transmit the message of the composer and the poet. And if we break past that line and our voice is no longer in command of our mind, what's wanting to be transmitted doesn't get transmitted. So it's, you have to kind of boil the emotion to a certain pitch that is just at that line, and then hopefully let it live there while your mind and emotion meet and pour out what it is you want to say. Whereas I think someone like Springsteen can cross that line with his voice, and yet still the music, the particular music that he does, actually gains from that self-immolating type thing. I mean, I think back when I was, you know, 21 at Tanglewood, a student, and I gave a performance of some Schubert songs where, I mean, at the end of it, I simply couldn't talk. And that was fine for being 21 years old, because the ardor, you know, carries the message, as it were. But that wouldn't be fine, because in the end run, what Mr. Schubert asks me to do is to transmit something with the sound of my voice, as well as my emotion and my intellect.
What's the most difficult decision you've had to make about your work as a singer?
I think limiting myself to what I can serve best. You know, in classical music, there are different size voices, different shaped voices. People have different strengths. And to really know, for instance, that I will not sing Wagner, you know, just, you know, that ain't going to happen because my voice wasn't made to do that. And you reach a point, you know, I'm 37 now, I think just in your early 30s, when you really know what it is that you can do and what it is you can't do. And sometimes facing those things you can't do brings a certain kind of sadness, you know, things you'd love to do. But I'm so lucky because there's so much to do that I kind of don't, you know, worry about it so much.
I want to get back to when you were hearing Leontine Price for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know you could sing?
I knew I wanted to sing. I didn't know that I could sing. No, it's a good question. I didn't know that I could sing. I just knew I wanted to sing. And it's funny, it's not that I wanted to do that thing which she does, which is, I mean, she was the greatest kind of, she poured the greatest amount of beautiful sound, you know, on us year in and year out. So it wasn't that, it's just I wanted to sing. I wanted to do the thing that's behind her singing, you know, heart and voice, and let it kind of move through me. And since I didn't, even through my college years, I didn't have a conventionally operatic voice, I never thought about what my voice sounded like. I just kept doing what I knew I wanted to do and let my voice follow and hope that it served the needs of the music.
Well, you have a beautiful voice, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your singing.
Thank you.
Baritone Sanford Sylvan. His new album, Beloved That Pilgrimage, includes Aaron Copland's settings of some of Emily Dickinson's poems.